Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the American University's Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's Energy and Environmental Markets and Finance Committee. This is the Hot Air Show, your resource for insight and opinion on energy and environmental markets, law, and policy. Let's get started and have our panel introduce themselves.
Tyson Slocum, I direct the energy program at Public Citizen.
Toby Short, Director of Federal Governmental Affairs at Duke Energy.
Bill Snape, Center for Biological Diversity and a practitioner in residence here at the Washington College of Law.
Kevin Book, I'm an energy analyst at Clearview Energy Partners.
Before we get to discussions about the election policy and a few court decisions of interest, I think it's first worth marking that the Commodities Futures Trading Commission got it right in their last rulemaking. They did not classify environmental commodities, allowances, offsets, renewable energy certificates, all types of various instruments used in environmental markets as swaps. Instead, they properly classified them as environmental commodities, recognizing that they can be physically settled and that, quite frankly, they're commodities. They serve an end that cash cannot. They're consumed for a purpose that cash cannot fulfill. It is a good ruling. If the ruling had gone the other way, it would have had significant ramifications for project finance in renewable energy, in the carbon markets, and so on. The collateral margins that projects would have had to maintain would have been quite prohibitive to capital formation around these projects. And overall, it was a good decision. So before we say anything, I wanted to give a shout-out to the CFTC. Thank you for getting it right.
Will it sway the election, Chris?
It will have absolutely nothing to do with the election. But there are a certain amount of folks around the country who are very relieved, myself included. So,
an agency most people have never heard of has just been thanked for something that nobody noticed.
Yes, now that we've dived to the very deepest reaches of the wonky rabbit hole, let's climb back up and ask, guys, can we expect anything out of the government this close to the election? The conventional wisdom is nothing. Is it indeed nothing? Tyson?
The only thing we're going to see is a continuing aggressive campaign by special interests flooding the airwaves and internet ads to try and make up Americans' minds on various energy policies. But in terms of congressional or executive branch action, I don't see anything prior to the election.
I don't see anything prior to the election. I think that the Congress has another week to go, and they're going to pass the CR, get out of town, and start, you know, really campaigning as if they haven't been doing it for the last 2 years. So,
and that's really becoming a quite a common moment here in D.C., the passing of the CR and getting out of town. I mean, it feels like we haven't had a smooth budget cycle, let alone an appropriation cycle, let alone a policy cycle since, all the way back since 2000.
I agree with both Tyson and Toby. I think that is the conventional wisdom. What's interesting to me about the current campaign, though, is how little both candidates are talking about climate change per se. It's come up very infrequently. I think the only real mention of it in Romney's speech was that he doesn't view it as his job to control ocean level rise, which is an interesting assertion as the president of the most powerful country in the world. But what's interesting is I think we're talking about energy and talking about fossil fuels, but we're not talking about climate change on the campaign trail right now. It is a fascinating dichotomy.
Is that just because it's received a certain amount of stigma in certain base constituencies that don't want to hear it? I mean, has this race, Kevin, turned out into who can turn out the base most strongly, and therefore terms that are seen as divisive, like climate change, hopefully not on the science, but certainly on the policy. What are your thoughts?
A strong economy would have set the stage for a policy discussion. This worked, this didn't work. It's possible we may still have one. But it is all about turning out the base, and so as such, nothing contentious in energy policy is coming up. If you look at what else is not being discussed, it includes some things that very well might be revisited after November 6th. Things like the decision to export LNG. Things like the New York Department of Environmental Conservation's view on fracking in New York State. Questions about whether or not you're going to extend production tax credits for wind. nothing is coming up. Everybody is talking about energy, but no one is willing to say anything because the costs of losing even a single vote in a race where there's so many people who are so unhappy, they're so high.
But most folks know where it's going to fall out from a policy standpoint, who's pushing what and so on. Is it just that the overall general election nature makes it so we can't get specific?
The part of it is in fact, that the forum doesn't lend itself to specifics when you're speaking in 10-second sound bites and panoramic views and commercials. But there is a forum for discussion, and the presidential debate is one of those forums. It's a very good one, and Twitter-assisted and technologically enabled. It's possible that it could be the forum for a real debate about some issues. It's just that energy right now has become more of a symbol than a plan. It's something that you use to represent either jobs or risk. It's not necessarily something people want to dig into the details about.
Wouldn't it be lovely if we could have like a 10 solid minutes in one of the debates on energy?
We need
How sweet would that be?
We need to, because one of the issues is that issues that were not contentious at all a couple of years ago are all of a sudden very contentious. You've got the Romney campaign coming out and saying that the fuel economy standards are radical, right? These were consensus-driven. They initiated within the Bush administration. You've got other issues like support for alternative sources of energy, particularly renewables, that has become politicized, and the issue of climate change, which just a couple of years ago was safe ground for many Republicans to discuss, now is off limits. And so you've really seen a very sharp shift in the energy policy debate away from issues where we had broad consensus a couple of years ago to now it's just nothing but political infighting.
Light bulbs.
Right. Light bulbs is a perfect example. It's crazy that basic efficiency standards that were agreed upon by consumer groups, industry, members of both political parties are now a lightning rod for the Tea Party. And the lack of informed debate on these issues within the party structures is what's been so disappointing.
It seems to be present across the board that we're not having that level of detailed debate. But again, as you know, Kevin points out, in an election that's about turning out the bases, it can be hard to achieve that type of debate. One thing I found that is interesting, Obama has had an all of the above approach to his energy policy for quite some time. And I've noticed recently in some of the speeches that I heard Governor Romney giving that he's begun to list renewables, gas, and so on. It's almost as if he's taking an all-of-the-above approach. That seems to reinforce this generalistic approach. We need to use all the resources that we can bring to bear. The other thing that I think is interesting is that if you look at a lot of the stats that are being bring to bear, folks are taking more of a hemispheric view of our energy system and talking about energy independence. So we'll see how that plays.
Chris, can I just disagree slightly?
Sure.
I mean, I think your main point is well taken, but I do want to distinguish something that I believe the Romney campaign has done that I find not only troubling but befuddling given his past history is somewhat moderate. And I realize he's being pushed to the right by the Tea Party that Tyson mentions. But I don't think Romney's approach is all the above, at least rhetorically right now. Just within the last 24 hours, his lead energy advisor wants to increase subsidies for oil and gas production in this country. They have clearly focused on the fossil fuel part of this more than the all of the above. Now, if Romney were to be elected, do I believe that he would be more like Obama, all the above? Yes, I think he would definitely look at wind and solar were he be elected. But rhetorically right now, he is much more focused on fossil fuels on the campaign trail. And it's surprising to me to some degree.
I think it's often because the fossil fuel sector is one that gets framed as being constrained regulatorily. At the same time, the Obama administration has said that we've seen more development, more lands open for leasing, more leases executed in the last several years than we've had for quite a period before. What is interesting, though, is that often it gets couched within the specter of over-government regulation, and the EPA tends to be the leading candidate for that. And EPA has actually had a mixed ride in the courts recently in front of the D.C. Circuit. Between now and the last show that we had, the tailoring rule was upheld in front of the D.C. Circuit. Now, it's interesting because you can look at the tailoring rule on the endangerment finding and so on as kind of some of the initial gates to the realm of EPA climate regulation. Toby, from your perspective, did that change anything when the tailoring rule got upheld, endangerment finding got upheld? Did that shift opinion on where EPA climate regulation was going from your perspective in the utility space?
No, I think we anticipated that it would all be upheld. But you make a point about the tailoring rule. The fact, and one could argue that they did the tailoring rule because the Clean Air Act didn't take into account carbon, or that wasn't, you know, it sort of reinforces the idea that when the Clean Air Act amendments were done, they really weren't looking at carbon. Because in statute you have a threshold, and now they're saying, well, in this limited case, we're going to change that threshold through agency action. So one could argue that by doing that, you're sort of admitting that carbon was not necessarily being talked about when you were doing that. You know, the thing about Congress is you try to do something, but you can't anticipate all the arguments, and you can't anticipate everything to regulate. And in most cases, you wouldn't want Congress to try to regulate every single aspect or whatever could come up. Mm-hmm. But for us, I you know, we anticipated that it would be upheld. So it doesn't really change anything for us moving forward. What we're looking at now that they've come out with you know, talking about new sources, is now we're looking at current sources and what's the rules going to be moving forward with those. I think that it's not the greatest thing in the world to say, well, we set new source performance standards at natural gas levels because everybody's going to natural gas. Well, if we funnel everything to natural gas, then there's, you know, the chance that over the last 10 years we've seen it where gas prices are volatile and they go up.
Yeah. To Kevin's point, if we ramp, you know, export, you know, infrastructure faster than we ramp, you know, pipelines and, you know, gathering networks to keep the gas here, we could run into some of those issues.
Right. And I was reading a study one time that said that it would take $10 CFT
for MCF.
Yeah, for MCF, yeah. To make a company indifferent about coal or natural gas. Mm-hmm. So at $2 and what, 30 something cents,
yeah,
you know, you see the logical alternative. And as a company, Duke Energy is moving towards more using more natural gas, but with the vision that it could go up in the future. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, when you're having to deal with state regulators, like in North Carolina and others, they look strictly at today's cost. You know, what is the cost for the consumer, the low cost for the consumer today? Yeah. And you're basically forced to do that, not thinking that, you know, in 5 years, 6 years, whatever, if that spikes up like it has in the past, what's that going to mean to the consumer? Because in most instances, a company has a rider to pass along fuel costs. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we really have to look at. And you talked about renewables. My view of that is that for the longest time, you put the cart before the horse in a sense of saying, let's do renewables, knowing full well you had to do backup capacity. Now, if I'm the renewable industry, I'm saying we've had all this, you know, expansion of natural gas infrastructure, and when the prices start to go back up, if I'm selling, you know, renewables, I'm going to you and saying, I have a way to mitigate your costs, your financial exposure to natural gas by 25 to 35% based on the capacity factor of like wind or things like that. Install wind. And that way you're going to, you know, I'm going to reduce your cost 25 to 35%. If I'm a company and there's wind abound or something like that, I'm going to say, that's a great idea, especially if it spikes like it has in the last 7 years.
And we've already seen in the market some of the initial, you know, folks coming out there offering, you know, power products that are backed by both, you know, gas generation, mm-hmm. to keep always on, and by renewables to add a green, you know, more emissions-friendly component to it. And that type of collaboration we're seeing on a number of fronts between, you know, ACOR, gas associations. There's this sense, and it's interesting, that, you know, renewables and gas have shared interests, that they're grouping with energy efficiency, that those are the type of technologies that are going to be increasingly deployed at the community scale. And behind the meter, and that as those types of deployments, projects, financings penetrate and grow, it helps reduce the need for more central station generation. So to a certain extent, you know, some folks I talked to said the future really is community-scale renewables, community-scale gas, you know, more CHP, lots more energy efficiency, improve the way our buildings use power, and that the old central station coal plant model, nuke model, and even to a certain extent the large utility-scale wind farm, the large, you know, massive renewables arrays, that those, simply because they're central station, are becoming less emphasized, and we're seeing more of this emphasis at the community level.
SMRs are a perfect example. I'm sorry, Tyson. No. SMRs are a perfect example of the decentralized type situation where you're looking at doing it at different places and different levels. As a utility company, you know, our model, you know, our business model, we have to look at it. And we have to look at the disruptive technology. And, you know, you call it disruptive. It's not necessarily disruptive in the sense that everyone understands the word disruption, but that would essentially take people away from the product that we're selling today. And if companies aren't doing that, utility companies at my level and Duke Energy's level, then they're doing their customers and they're doing, you know, their investors, quite frankly, a huge disservice.
Didn't John Wellinghoff, when he first became chairman back in early 2009, say something to your point, Chris, where he said, central base load generation is becoming increasingly obsolete. We've got to go to localized distributed sources. And there was so much pushback that he was forced to almost immediately retract those comments.
He swallowed those words whole.
It seems to be an evolution. If you look at what FERC has done, they've certainly passed rules that increase the value of what I'll call dynamic resources, resources that can perform at the distributed level, have a lot of value above and beyond, whether it's on the environmental side, the ramp rate side, the regulation side, the fuel side, you name it. They have advantages above and beyond just the raw electron. We'll see. It certainly seems like an evolution. What's interesting is the way that it's beginning to align policy platforms among technology groups in ways that we haven't seen it happen before. One thing I do want to get back to quickly on the tailoring rule and get Bill's opinion on this, because I do think it's interesting. Your point, Toby, that you needed the tailoring rule because Congress didn't contemplate CO2 at that point in time.
I said that sort of does the argument.
Toby didn't say that, but that is the Toby.
One
is,
could say.
Toby is accurately informing us of the argument that's out there. Bill, would a counter argument that be that the Clean Air Act's framework is auto executing? It's automatic, and once certain scientific determinations are made, the gears turn.
I think that's basically right. And the thing about the tailoring rule, Toby, I agree with much of, if not all, of what you said. The issue with the tailoring rule from a legal and enforcement perspective was the court, aside from saying that the industry plaintiffs had no standing,
right,
but I think the policy issue underlying it was EPA can decide as a matter of its prosecutorial discretion how it begins the process of enforcing a regulation. They do not have to do it all at once. They can start with the big emitters and work their way down, and I think that is a rational way to look at it, and I think there are principles in the law that support that. But I want to go back to the dialogue we were just having about Wellinghoff and about a reality catching up to rhetoric, because the D.C. Circuit decision on the endangerment finding, a part of that tailoring rule decision, to me also encapsulates that. Think about what occurred in that decision. We all take it for granted because we're so immersed in it, but I think it's very significant historically. Judge Sentell, the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit, highly conservative, Republican appointee, author of the Massachusetts versus EPA decision that was later overturned by the Supreme Court, writes in that D.C. Circuit opinion just a month ago that the science of climate change is convincing, that EPA has done its job compiling that science, that industry complaints about that science are completely bunk and, in fact, takes a couple rips at industry in the process of doing that. I mean, that is significant. And while we all, I think, are anxious to move ahead beyond just mere endangerment, we all know that there's an endangerment issue. I think all of us around the table agree with that. There's some more hard work to do. At least now it appears as though we don't have to argue about that anymore. We might have to argue a little bit about it with the Tea Party politics, but it seems as though the body politic is now finally admitting this is a serious issue, and that is important.
It'd be interesting if the the voters responded to some, you know, appellate court judge in D.C.
If they did that, then they would demonstrate an awareness and interest in the judicial process and the broader political debate that would probably obviate a lot of the rhetoric which has clouded debate up until this point. If you look at what you just said, Bill, it's one of the two really important things, I think, that we're talking about this summer. The second is that the Obama administration did finalize CAFE standards, which markedly reduce greenhouse gas emissions from one sector of the economy over the course of a very far-reaching and distant future from a regulatory perspective, out through 2025. And if you look at what they did, it is, of course, subject to criticism from Republicans, and rhetorically, it sounds like putting big Americans into small cars in a way that they don't like. But what they did is they recast fuel economy as emissions and allowed the flexibility program for fuel economy to bleed into emissions regulation. And if you were going to look at what the regulatory framework that Toby mentioned could look like in the next Obama term, if there is a next Obama term, and I think the statistical probability of that is high, then you have a case for tradable performance standards already in business. Not only have judges acknowledged endangerment and reinforced it, but we've now completed the process of putting into practice an entire sectoral flexibility program for performance standards.
But much of the crediting system for CAFE was in existence. It was just amplified significantly and tied into the climate issue in a way that it hadn't been done before, and that flexibility, so that people will still get their F-150s as long as a certain amount of Ford Focus hybrids get sold.
You can still burn coal, Toby, and do it with my blessing as long as you've got some wind on the grid.
Mm-hmm. Well, which is why some have criticized these new fuel efficiency standards as being partly bunk, you know, as not really representing the type of savings that the administration is claiming. But I agree, at least it's a step forward.
It's not pure enough for you.
Yeah. Well, are we really getting the carbon reductions that they're claiming? Are we really going to have 54.5, or is it really going to be, because of this system, a much lower standard? I think that's a legitimate point to debate.
It moves the technology momentum towards emphasis on the advanced materials, equipment, and so on that can achieve that. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed in the debate over the years is if you look back in the early years of the CAFE debate, the question of increasing the standards in many cases was one of downweighting the cars. And in the old days, that had a safety impact. Today, with advanced materials, technology, design, and so on, it does not seem like there's really a big safety issue to where EPA is trying to take us. The really question is what's the cost issue to the average consumer? And that comes down to economists like Kevin telling us about how quickly those technology sectors can.
So the we did the math and did a report almost no one will read that shows it's about $50 to $350 per mile per gallon gained over the course of the standards in incremental cost between 2017 and 2025. And if you look at the payback that EPA establishes, they use all the most favorable discount rates. They come up with a very rosy picture, but for the marginal buyer of a car, any amount of money above what you can afford is a reason you don't buy that car. And so there's a real reason, Bill, you should be afraid that those standards aren't actually implemented by some future administration when the industry squawks because it can. And your comment is also fair because they've exempted electric vehicles from upstream power plant emissions through 2021, which is the only way they're ever going to get electric vehicles anywhere close to a major part of anyone's fleet, because no one wants to buy an electric vehicle, unless, of course, anyone around the table happens to have one, in which case I apologize. Do you really?
Our company hasn't. Our company's moving to total electric vehicles. Well,
you kind of have to, though. It's like the Kool-Aid if you don't drink your fire.
I'm just waiting for the electric sports car boom when all the car nuts like me realize that you have 100% of your torque at 0.001 RPM.
Well, just to complete the point, though, Bill, pure is the enemy of the good, and the fact that the EPA has been pragmatic enough to put this framework in place does, in conjunction with some of the other things we're talking about, set the stage for the shadow carbon agenda to come out of the shadows.
Shadow carbon agenda. I like it. You know, it's like the dark pools of policy.
It makes it kind of spooky and sexy.
It is. You know, anything, yeah.
Well, I accept that criticism. I don't back away from it. But I think that is a fair point, which is why I worded it the way I did. But you still have with other vehicles, planes, trains, ships, administration has no desire to be regulating those significant sources of greenhouse pollution. You have a whole laundry list of things under the Act that the administration still hasn't done. So, I think what I was trying to say is you've got baby steps by this administration, and it very well may be right, Kevin and Chris, that this is putting in place the architecture so that we can really get some things done in 4 years, but we've heard that line before. I'm slightly skeptical.
Don't blame you a bit. No, certainly. I'm curious that, we've talked about the D.C. Circuit. They've been active on other fronts. They recently struck down the cross-state air pollution rule, and it's too complex to get into. But at a high level, I think it's interesting that EPA came out, put the Clean Air Interstate rule out. The court said, no, don't work. Doesn't work. You breached the black letter clause of the Clean Air Act. Go back and redesign it. And by the way, Section 126, interstate air pollution, the good neighbor provisions of the Clean Air Act, got to look into that stuff too. They came out with the cross-state air pollution rule. The court said, no, not going to work for us. Now, much more of a split decision than was around CARE, but CARE is still in place. You talk to folks in the criteria emissions markets, and no one knows what to do. You talk to folks who are looking at managing asset portfolios of generation, and what I frequently hear is that we don't know what's going on with SOx and NOx. We do think that mercury and toxics, utility max stands on stronger ground. It's certainly stronger ground than boiler mac. We won't get into boiler mac. But it seems to be that but for heavy metals and toxics, there is a massive amount of uncertainty if you hold a portfolio of generation right now as to how you're going to be required to control your emissions across the board. Now, that said, you talk to folks and they say if you're going to put in controls for toxics, most of the rest of the stuff's going to be there anyway. You're going to have SCR in place. You're going to have decent scrubbers bags and so on. So my question to you guys is, are we going to see anything other than toxics emissions policy direction when it comes to emissions regulation on the federal level anytime soon?
Casper's a ghost. And the reason is that the mercury and air toxic standards, as you say, will require catalytic reduction, will require filtration, and most of the transporting of pollutants that would have been an interstate issue will be eliminated in many of the plants that are retrofitted, and the retirements will still occur. At this point, it may not actually be necessary to do that, but from a practical portfolio management perspective, what it does is it buys 3 years when you don't have to do exactly what you would have had to do at the start of 2012. If EPA fails twice to convince the court and EPA tries again, EPA has no one to blame but itself.
Can I jump in? It's a very interesting economic regulatory theory that I actually am not sure I can agree or disagree with. I need to digest that. So that very well may be right that it doesn't ultimately matter, is what I heard you saying. But I do want to talk a little bit more about the law of that decision. I agree with Chris. It is a highly dense opinion or opinions with a dissent. Too much to get into all the technicalities. But I think there are some things about it that are interesting. First is, I'm convinced the Obama administration will seek en banc review of the decision. Judge Rogers wrote a blistering dissent. Judge Rogers is very close to Chief Judge Sentell, who we previously talked about. And the majority decision was written by Brett Kavanaugh, who we, at least I believe, is sort of on this ideological search and destroy mission for against all regulation. He certainly did that when he was George W. Bush's counsel at the White House. And what I think is technically most interesting about the decision is that Kavanaugh seems to be holding EPA to a standard that is literally unachievable with regard to how it is they're going to monitor and test these cross-state pollutants. This is really an issue of tort. Some states are screwing other states. They're making those other states, particularly in New England and along the coast, make it impossible for those states to comply with their state implementation plans. And so the states that are creating the pollution that's going downwind to these other states should be remedied somehow.
So you don't buy the procedural standpoint that, before EPA steps in and takes over, puts in a federal implementation plan, that you need to have some process where the neighbor tells the other neighbor, you're screwing with me. You need to incorporate
you're messing with my air quality into your state implementation plan, and kind of work it down the ways. You felt that, it sounds like, Bill, that the what EPA did in automating more of that process was well within their authority.
I think so, but you're conflating a little bit two issues that I think we need to separate out for purposes of what Kavanaugh did. You're right. He did criticize the federal insertion into the state implementation plan process, and there's a lot of reasons why what Kavanaugh did was probably incorrect. But that almost doesn't matter. Those procedural issues could be worked out. You can do another rulemaking. That's fine. I think the far more disturbing part of Kavanaugh's decision is this data information that he's demanding of EPA. He's demanding this mode of specificity that he has to know is very difficult, bordering on impossible. He's setting EPA up for failure. And it's not as though EPA is doing this alone. The downwind states are saying the same thing, downwind states that have Republican governors. So that's the part of the decision that is disturbing.
And that's what the dissent pointed out, that that threshold of specificity is higher than has been established precedentially.
By the D.C. Circuit itself.
Yes.
I think one of the big lessons to be learned here is that the remarkable statute that is the Clean Air Act, these different court decisions are creating a ton of uncertainty. And meanwhile, the industry is stalled about where we're going to go forward for hundreds of billions of dollars of investments for the next generation to meet our energy needs. And even though all of the fossil fuel extractive industries are having a great time financing ads, beating up on the EPA, beating up on regulations in general, after the silly season of the election is over, these same industries are going to be talking to Speaker Boehner and others and saying, okay, look, that was a lot of fun to kick the EPA around, but the fact of the matter is we need some sort of national energy plan going forward. We're going to have to deal with emissions. We have to have the kind of sane proposal that we see in the transportation sector with fuel economy standards. We need to see that in the electric generation sector. And so I do think that even though it looks remote now through the dust of the election, I think you're going to have some sort of requirement for negotiation and consensus among industry and environmentalists from a legislative standpoint in the next Congress and the next administration to deal with all these issues to get a path forward. Or is that simply too idealistic?
Well, it is ideal, but just to follow on that, it's fascinating because everyone's always wanted a national energy policy, and to take a view that I'm not going to cage as skeptical because I think it's also hopeful. We might never achieve that level of coordination, but what we're seeing is competition in the power sector, in particular, breaking into end use and levels of the power sector in ways we haven't seen it before. So we might not have a national energy policy, but federalism in some ways is at work as you see more and more dynamic resources more and more energy services penetrating and a more dynamic energy grid that doesn't flow one way, but that flows multiple ways. And you see companies like Duke and others that have, developed dynamic and competitive unregulated businesses that have been creative in how they've looked at working with what were traditionally, demand-side management programs and vertical monopolies and so on. Could it be, guys, I guess my question to you, that we'll never see, we can talk about this coordinated national energy policy, but we'll never see it, but instead we're going to see competition just percolate up on the regional, the ISO, the RTO, and in particular the state level, and then that's how we're going to get to many of the transformations that we're talking about.
The parochialism of our resource base and the fragmentation of our regulatory system makes national policy only possible when everybody needs something, and most of them need the same thing. We do occasionally have national policy proposals that ultimately fall victim to preserving states' rights to do whatever states want to do. It isn't easy, and I think your hopeful bottom-up approach is probably ultimately what's going to have to happen. You see a lot of industry standards and trade groups taking the place in energy of a federal plan. I suspect that in cooperation with environmentalists, you may start to see more of the stronger approach in fracking, the state regulation
approach, possibly not as strong as you'd like it, Tyson, but more of this sort of loose federation type policy. How are you going to convince a world as disparate as North Carolina and the Pacific Northwest to agree on the same regulatory policy?
Unless it's broad enough. And I think when you get to issues like our imports and exports of LNG and all of the federal regulation in the wholesale energy markets, there are ties that can be used to strengthen and bind. We can get a national energy policy in place. I think part of the issue is that when you talk to folks who are managing portfolios and generation and serving load, uncertainty seems to be the name of the game. I mean, I was in with a client's CapEx committee just recently, and, you can ask any of the folks on the committee to take a whiteboard, and in a heartbeat, they can come up with multiple bullets as to why they're nervous about spending a drop. I mean, the election obviously is the first one, but the fiscal cliff that folks talk about with the tax policy, if we don't have either a continuance of it or a positive wholesale change, no one knows what it's going to fall out to be. You know, in the power sector, we don't have the certainty. I mean, we're driving down the criteria emissions road, you know, in a car that the court said was a piece of crap, you know, and the car we tried to get into, the court said, no, that's even crappier, so go back and drive your junker some more. It's quite tough to find that certainty when someone wants to make investments in the portfolios, and that's kind of what drives it to that safe ground of it's all of the above. Because if I'm doing a bit of everything, I've spread my bets.
So we started this with what's going to happen in Congress. You know, you just talked about the fiscal cliff. There's been a lot of, and we've been talking about emissions, and there's been a lot of, I don't want to say a lot of talk, but some comments or things like that regarding carbon tax. And with the tax situation, the deficit situation, wanting to regulate carbon or other emissions or things like that, how does this group, I guess, view the ability to implement a carbon tax? I mean,
the merits of it and the ability to.
We, as most people know, Duke Energy operates in a lot in the Southeast, and therefore we have a lot of conservative members that we serve their districts. So I sort of know where they're coming from, but you have to remember that a lot of conservative members ran on the prospect of reducing the federal deficit. It's easy to look from beyond and say, well, all we got to do is slash spending and do these things. And that's, part of it. But from the left side of the equation, everybody talks about revenue raisers. And we talk about oil and gas, provisions or anything like that. Is this could this be part of a revenue raiser? I know Mr. Waxman's talked about it.
Public Citizen was participating in these more than year-long behind-the-scenes talks between liberal and moderate and conservative factions. The most recent meetings were hosted by American Enterprise Institute, and that's there was a leaked agenda that was widely publicized. AEI was just simply hosting the meeting. They weren't the organizer of all this. But definitely, our discussions were focused around the fiscal cliff. And the concern that we raised along with other groups is that instituting a carbon tax in exchange for slashing corporate income taxes or getting rid of the estate tax, we are absolutely not going to support that. And that's why I found it interesting that so many other conservative fiscal policy groups attacked AEI for participating in this, because actually AEI was doing what a lot of conservative groups' dream has been, is to put in some sort of regressive tax on consumers in exchange for slashing corporate income tax rates and things like that. But the fact is that you currently see a huge debate within the community. And the environmental community, I don't think, is being very sophisticated about this, because there's a lot of environmental groups that are like, we want a carbon tax in there no matter what the trade-off is. And then you've got groups like mine that say, look, a carbon tax is only going to be effective if you've got some sort of consumer mitigation in there, or else you're going to have backlash and you're going to absolutely harm a lot of vulnerable populations, which includes the middle class. So I am fully supportive of the concept of some sort of carbon pricing scheme, not necessarily a carbon tax, but you know, we were on record as supporting the Cantwell-Collins cap and dividend approach. But I think that talking about it in terms of being a necessary revenue raiser is a good thing, but it can't be the only pillar that you're resting on. That it has to be part of providing funding for renewable energy deployment and R&D, consumer mitigation, in addition to deficit reduction.
Well, it seems everybody agrees across the spectrum that the concept that, you know, we should tax bads, not goods. And right now, I think much of the debate is what's bad and what's good. You frequently hear the view that a carbon tax is a very blunt instrument, a very blunt policy instrument. It can be regressive, and it also does not have a cap. You know, cap and trade, other types of mechanisms that actually, you know, have a hard cap on the level of emissions have more guarantee as to where you're actually going to achieve ultimately on the policy aims. All that said, I find it interesting that this would be a way that you start to get the carbon price signal into the economy. And even if you're ramping it in slow, and even if it's followed by something more stringent in the future, it's a way to get the carbon price signal in, to make it mean something more than a, you know, a stakeholder, you know, marketing-focused participation in disclosure or reporting, to make it have some, you know, more economic teeth in how it's going to you know, be an issue for businesses and others to consider. It is fascinating, though, because, you know, is it just being used right now? You know, Kevin, is it just being used as a way to open the door, or open, as some would say, Pandora's box to the broader tax reform package, the broader debate about, you know, goods and bads, and that folks have found out that if you want to have that debate, you got to give everybody something to talk about in that debate, and carbon tax is something for the left to come in and speak about.
So what you're saying is if we talk about something that can't possibly happen, can we have a conversation using that as the pretext? With full disclosure that I Republicans invited me twice to the Hill to testify against bad cap-and-trade schemes, and I did dutifully do that. And in both testimonies, I argued for a carbon tax, probably disappointing my hosts, and also about the regressivity of any carbon pricing scheme. And those issues make the carbon tax a disaster, but what you're really doing is transferring wealth from coal to other fossil sectors of the economy, unless you have a balancing mechanism. And I would think most environmentalists would support that, because the effective reductions in the thing they hate most would probably be worthwhile. But if you actually think this can happen, you have to think about the context where it could happen. And the only context we think it can happen in is the what now moment, which is something happens, all the pollsters are wrong, Romney wins, Republicans win their Senate control, and suddenly they've got a $16 trillion problem and no other answer. And then if you go back and look, you'll see that there's a warehouse of former Bush administration economists who think this is a good idea. They've talked about it. They talked about it behind closed doors when they were in captivity. And now that they're free, they're talking about it with no one to stop them, sometimes even at AEI. And it's actually a reasonable prospect, but only if you're willing to go two ifs from reality, which is if Romney wins and if you think people can have a sober discussion about taxation.
But would that require the Republican policy establishment to overcome the Tea Party win?
The Republican policy establishment would have to take Valium every minute of the entire conversation, not just because of Tea Party, but because it's anathema to promote a tax. The terms have to be preceded by the nullifying words, revenue neutral.
I hate it, Kevin, when I agree with you so much, and you make me laugh at the same time. But I will say this about the carbon tax. I've agreed with everything everyone said. The only way a carbon tax works, in my view, irrespective of the lay of the land or the prediction, the hypothetical Kevin just gave us, that tax fee money has to largely go back to the people. There's no other way it will be politically palatable. That's not to say it won't be politically jammed through. under the type of hypothetical you just gave us, Kevin, I agree that that could occur. But to me, a carbon tax only has political resonance, only does not become a punching bag if large sums, if not all of that money, goes right back to the taxpayer. Otherwise, it's just viewed as another government scam.
Isn't there another mechanism for how the taxpayer can have their value protected? And there was much discussion under cap and trade about the role of public utility commissions in controlling the amount of carbon costs passed through into retail rates. Could a similar role for PUCs in helping to protect the actual impact of the carbon tax on users' bills that come monthly be here?
Well, you know, we...
Ding us.
Well, it would. I mean, then that's the thing. But at the same time, that...
But our profits are already regulated, first.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing.
I saw a video from the Democratic National Convention, and this guy was walking around saying, should we limit the profitability of corporations? And a lot of people were saying, yes. And I'm sitting there going, our profits are already regulated. So how much more are you going to regulate? I mean, you know, if you're talking about in the sense of my customer pays $3 and therefore I'm going to make up the difference and make him whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do have rate unregulated affiliates, right? I mean, you've got your retail...
But eventually, you like that.
Yeah, you like the challenge is really when you're in an environment where, you know, economics are tight across the board, whether it's, you know, mortgages, food, housing, healthcare, and so on, for average Americans, how do you ramp in this transformation that everybody agrees needs to happen?
Well, I think you do it. I understand what you're saying. I think you and I understand what Bill's saying in terms of keeping it. You want to keep it at the localized level. Tyson mentioned Senator Cantwell's proposal, and that, you know, the cap and dividend, I believe it was, where you basically took in the money and then dividended it out to everybody across the board. So you had people in the Midwest, you know, actually losing money, whereas people in the Northwest were gaining money.
Y'all
have heard me say it all the time.
And we'd be supportive of tweaking the distribution formula.
Right. I mean, there's ways you could probably. I mean, there's ways you could empower the states to say.
Right.
Well, I mean, you can empower the states to say, okay, if $10 is being paid by, let's say, Indiana, for instance, you put it into maybe some kind of green bank or whatever, or customer mitigate or something like that within the state to help buy down, you know, the next technology or something like that, so the customer doesn't pay twice for it. Because let's say we're moving to building natural gas facility instead of a coal facility, so they're going to pay the carbon tax for the generation that's currently going, and they're going to pay for the new generation. So they're actually paying twice instead of just taking that money, putting it over here, and then buying down, you know, over there. So, you know, you get to the same end point without as much customer, without as much money coming out of the customer's pocket.
One of the things
I'm not saying we advocate for a carbon tax. I just wanted to bring it up for discussion because, you know, it's something that's relevant.
And it's fascinating because, at the Kevin's point, it's the T word that's being, you know, used in ways that many people wouldn't have. I mean, it was fascinating because some of the messaging that came out around carbon tax recently is things that you could not imagine would have been uttered in the last 5 years without, you know, doom falling upon that person. Honestly, that applies on both sides.
Do this fall to that person, you know, by about 50 points in a primary.
Fair point. That's right.
Hey, I'm noticing we don't have much time left on our hour or so, but I want to look at the flip side of the tax fee issue and look a little bit at subsidies. And I know everyone counts subsidies differently, and everyone's got an ox that they want to grind, bore, whatever it is, metaphor, cliche, right?
Yeah. As Senator Hollings used to say, you can drive that ox into the ditch.
Thank you for clarifying. But the recent politics around the House No More Solyndra vote was, to me, a microcosm of the point I'm going to try to make, which is you have environmental groups, public interest groups, and some of the far-right interest groups attacking that bill because it really is not ending subsidies. It's just ending subsidies to what the House majority doesn't like and increasing subsidies to nuclear and other, we think, harmful energy production under the Department of Energy grant programs. And the point I want to make about that is that regulation, I think, is going to continue to be fought about no matter what happens in the election. Clearly, regulation, people have a lot of different opinions about regulation, but if you're really trying to look at this budget problem that the United States has, the amount of money that goes out of the government right now in terms of subsidies is massive. And, you know, one idea I've had, which is not well-liked within the environmental community, is just end all of them. End them for oil and gas, end them for coal, end them even for renewables. Now, that is not well-liked, but
Institute loves it.
That is a huge amount of money.
You need to talk to a lot of the conservatives, you know, on the far-right side, because, from what I understand and in my discussions with them, they feel the same way. If you truly want the market to dictate prices, yes, then you get rid of everything.
But if we don't.
No,
they do.
Yeah, and the rejoinder would be if the market's not accurately assigning the right cost to certain activities, if the market's information, to go back to classical economics, isn't perfected, then you can wipe away all those taxes. But if you have certain activities that a core component of those activities, large emissions, that have real costs on society, are just allowed to kind of continue without having costs assigned to them. If you wipe away, is it still a level playing field, I guess?
No, and it goes back to one of the things I mentioned earlier about low-cost generation. You wipe away everything, what's the low-cost generation? And we build assets that we hope will last a long time, not just fly by night and, well, we'll, in like Apple, and next year we'll come out with the next biggest thing or whatever. We build these things to last for decades, and if the low cost today dictates that we build this asset, then we hope that it's going to be economical and affordable over the long term.
You know, by the way, I do wait outside my EPC company for the next, I wait overnight for the next combined cycle unit.
Right, exactly. So, and that's what I try to get across to a lot of the conservative members that we serve, is that, your argument might work in a lot of instances, but in our sector, it doesn't. It's not necessarily the case.
I think one of the problems with the loan guarantee system is, Congress originally proposed it because they wanted to do subsidies on the cheap, right? You could build in this fairly large subsidy but carry very little of it on the books unless you've got a bankruptcy, right? And because you're doing a subsidy on the cheap, it is not an effective subsidy. You're essentially putting DOE and Treasury officials in the job of a private equity firm to assess a company's business model and see whether or not it's deserving of support. Now, I understand that feed-in tariffs have a mixed record across the world, that countries have been dialing them back. Germany, at its heyday just a couple years ago, was spending $30 billion a year on its feed-in tariff. But the interesting thing to me about a feed-in tariff is that not only is the subsidy through rate base rather than through tax base, but that it is consumption-driven, right? And I think that when you look at why U.S. producers of renewable energy are suffering, it's because they do not have a coherent domestic market to sell their product into. And you have to create a domestic market. And I think that public subsidies can play a role. It has to be tightly controlled, but I think that moving into a feed-in tariff style system, I think, is going to be a requirement for that.
Well, it's interesting because, many a private equity firm fund, many a VC group would love to have the numbers that the loan guarantee program was put up. Because they've done pretty well when it comes to, if that was...
Well, so far.
So far. We'll see how things play out. But, the success rate on projects for something that was aimed to kind of bridge the valley of death, to give the leg up to technologies that the market wasn't comfortable enough to fund in totality on its own, it's done pretty well. Whether it's a good role of government is something that's certainly up for debate.
Well, let's talk about what that program was.
First of all, I disagree with you, Tyson, that on the cheap is bad. I like on the cheap. It's good. And I think that the subsidies are effective if the program is used for what it was intended for, which was that a portfolio anchored by, call it what it is, nuclear and coal plant assets, mm-hmm. which are low risk, low yield, would include room for shoot-the-moon green assets, mm-hmm. which would not represent the majority of the portfolio, but a small part of the portfolio. Now, the program is weakened by the fact that it runs by solicitations rather than as a green bank. So if you're going to imitate the private sector, you should function like the private sector. And there's a decent argument that the program made a number of choices that were probably bad, including the rush to get money out the door under 1705 before the door closed, because you're going to catch all the slow antelopes if you run after the herd. So the bottom line isn't that I think moving to debt subsidies is bad, but that we did it the wrong way. I would be terrified to live in an economy where we've made binding promises with a national tax base for an unlimited amount of spending on green energy, because if you look at what Germany is doing, although it's been very effective, freaking out about how much it costs.
And there is a cost story here, and that is that you're seeing the costs for community scale and behind the meter deployments, back to the theme I was talking about before, reduced dramatically to the point where, and I'm working on this myself, where if you can bring efficient capital sources, capital market access for these types of projects on a pooled basis and so on, all of a sudden, we're not talking about a green shot to the moon. We're not talking about, testing, new unproven technology. And we're not even talking about, that expensive technology compared to the alternatives. And so that is part of this revolution that I do think is going to come. To your point, where we're used to a system where it was upstream was where the low-cost efficiency was, and it worked its way downstream and so on. Upstream is central station. And now we're having a system where it's becoming more polar, with a pull downstream that's able to have more efficient deployment of energy resources, energy services, and as it gets married up to more efficient capital sourcing, it runs under the same basic behavioral underwriting theories that made utility bonds such a good deal. Utilities are serving all these communities, all these buildings. If someone's going to spend the CapEx to build the building, they're likely going to power it for a certain amount of time.
Can I be the ice in everybody's hot coffee right now?
Be the ice.
We're in a demand lull. Nothing is working like it's supposed to.
But why are we in a demand lull? We're in a demand lull, I'd argue, because we're seeing more of these community scale, behind the meter, efficiency to DG resources.
I wish that were so, but I think we're doing less with less and we're sucking it.
That's certainly part of it.
Because it's just terrible.
That's certainly part of it.
In the end use sectors. And if you look at history, what happens is that planning based around a normal, which is constrained by exogenous circumstances, suddenly turns out to be wildly inaccurate when real comes home. And you can look at California's power crisis and get a sense of what it might look like. If we want to be rational about this, we have to be serious about the way things work now, leaving headroom so that hopefully this diversification at the other end of the wire works. But it's not going to be the only solution to the capacity demands of an economy in recovery.
I agree with that, and that's why it's a transition. But I wouldn't equate what happened in California and what's kind of known as the California power crisis, where you make the mistake of capping retail rates but letting wholesale rates float,
predicated on a slow 1990s road. View that things would never speed back up.
Yeah.
Well, I want to take a slightly bigger picture view of what I think I'm hearing, which is that, and again, I think Kevin put his finger on it, if I heard him correctly, which is, the problems, many of the problems we're having with our energy policy and this demand issue have causations that have nothing to do with energy. They are inherent either politically bumblings by the Bush administration or inherent weaknesses within the market system itself. But they were not created by whatever energy policy we did or did not have.
Touché. You're just taking what I said and made me somehow responsible for imputing the market system and the Bush administration.
You mean you didn't fully agree with that?
I agree with this general, not so much the specifics.
Fair enough. Yeah. But the reason I say that is because...
Quite commonly tactical of you.
Well, I try.
from the left right now.
James Schlesinger, when he was Secretary of Energy, said we have two modes of energy policy in this country, complacency and panic. And I think he was right and continues to be right. And I just want to end, because I think we are nearing the time here, by reminding the audience, reminding all of us, that there are some common sense regulatory baselines or architecture bases that I think should be non-controversial and maybe will be a part of maybe not an explicit energy policy, Tyson, but an implicit agreement that we're not going to fight about certain things anymore. I think we all should be agreeing that for stationary sources like coal-burning power plants, we ought to have some basic new source performance standard and agreed upon new source review process. We may disagree about what the specifics are, but we need to move forward on that. I think we need to move forward on methane reductions. That's low-hanging fruit to deal with some of the methane pollution this country is producing and could be done at cost-benefit. No one has mentioned yet, we've implicitly talked about it, but no one's really said that Obama's oil production in the United States under his tenure is greater than in any other time since 2002. No. So looking at our drilling patterns, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad, but that's certainly different than what most people think has occurred.
We just passed Russia as the world's largest natural gas producer.
Exactly. Yeah, so I think we need to come to some agreement on that.
And new access technology.
Yeah, and the reason, like, and that's fracking and tidal.
Get me back.
Yeah, but if you also think about horizontal drilling in the Balkan shale. So, I mean, and that contributes a lot to what... Yeah. You know, how much oil we produce.
North Dakota is producing more oil than Alaska.
Yeah, tidal technology, fracking technology, and some of it was, you know, helped develop by the government to try to you know, get more efficiently at those reservoirs. Well, we've covered a broad range of topics in today's show, and at the end, I did hear Bill and Kevin agreeing with each other. And so at that nexus, we're going to wrap up. Thanks for joining us in the heat. We'll see you next time.